Newport Community College's main campus and is open Monday through Thursday, 8 a.m. to 6:30 p.m. and Friday, 8 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. Be sure to check out the HSCC College Store today.
The following program has been pre-recorded. The views expressed by the participants are not necessarily those of WHFR Radio or Henry Ford Community College. Welcome to We Are Not Alone, where local investigators as well as world-renowned scientists and ufologists share their latest evidence in support of the UFO reality. I'm David Twitchell, and you're listening to WHFR Dearborn. WHFR.FM is the station making waves, and for the next hour, we will be exploring the mysteries of the UFO and abduction phenomenon. And we have two guests today. Mr. Dennis Balthasar will be joining us soon. But first, we're going to be talking about the underground bases and Egyptian pyramids and how they tie in with the UFO phenomenon. But first, Nick Pope, widely known as the foremost expert on UFOs, worked for the British government for 21 years at the Ministry of Defense in charge of their UFO project. And he has been dubbed the real Fox Mulder. After in-depth investigations into the UFO phenomenon from within Britain's government, Pope believes with 99% certainty that we are not alone. He is an author, journalist, lecturer, and TV personality. He has been interviewed on countless TV and radio shows, as well as documentaries on the subject. And today we are privileged to have Nick Pope on the line with us to talk to him about those things and also the new movie out called Super 8. So let's get right to that. Well, welcome to the show, Mr. Pope.
Thank you, David. It's good to be on.
How are you?
Fine, thank you.
There's a new movie out called Super 8. Tell us about that.
Well, Super 8 is a collaboration between Steven Spielberg and J.J. Abrams. Hmm. So, as you can imagine, it's absolutely first class.
I guess.
And there is obviously a lot of speculation about what it's about, and I'm not going to spoil things too much for people. suffice to say that maybe something was being secreted away at Area 51. There's a train wreck. Something maybe gets loose, and strange things start to happen in the nearby town.
Hmm. That's all you can share with us, is that it?
Well, I think, put it this way, mm-hmm. It's a movie that's going to get people thinking about two of the most profound questions we can ask ourselves. What's out there? Are we being visited? Those sorts of things. But I think I've had a sneak peek, but you'll really have to wait till June the 10th and go and see it. But you won't be disappointed. And I think it's going to get a lot of people talking.
Yeah, already out there. Well, okay, now, is this a fictional story? I know it's fiction, but is it strictly fiction or fiction based upon actual UFO cases?
Well, it's not really something that you would say blends the two. I think this is more about imagination and belief and speculation. It's not one of these movies that almost reads like a documentary.
Okay.
But that's the great thing, though. One of the other themes of the movie again, without wanting to give too much away, but it's a theme that the UFO community are fascinated by, is this whole question, does the government maybe know more about this than they're letting on? And people love a mystery, but people love a conspiracy, too.
Yeah. Well, now, you worked with the government, the British government, for, what, 21 years, right?
I worked for the Ministry of Defense,
right.
Part of the British government, yes, for 21 years, and for much of the early 90s, my job was to research and investigate UFO sightings and to see if there was anything of any defense interest, and I concluded that there was. Some of these cases were absolutely fascinating.
Right. Well, when you went into the your job there, what was your opinion on all these wacky UFO reports?
Well, some of them were wacky. Some of them were just intriguing, and some of them we managed to explain, of course. There's a lot of misidentifications, a lot of hoaxes. Some were more interesting, and those included sightings from police officers, from pilots, from military personnel, UFOs tracked on radar, that sort of thing.
Okay. So when you got out of your job there, your opinion changed, obviously.
Well, I went in very much as a skeptic, but I went out, I think, not maybe a fully paid-up believer,
mm-hmm.
but someone who was certainly prepared to speculate on what might be out there. And, you know, that's why movies like Super 8, I think, are interesting and intriguing. They get us thinking about those questions.
Right.
And by the way, in collaboration with Super 8, 7-Eleven are now offering... there's a promotional campaign called Check Into Space. You go to a 7-Eleven store, you check in on Foursquare, and one lucky person will get the chance to actually go into space.
Wow.
So for all the details of that, you can go to 7-Eleven.com and check it out.
Okay. And for the trailer on the movie, where do we go?
You can just go. I think it's on the Paramount website. But if you just Google Super 8 trailer, it'll come out tops. So enjoy the movie and have fun with the 7-Eleven Super 8 promotion.
Well, very good. I appreciate you coming on. Very quickly, though, is the government hiding something? The British government?
No, I've worked on this for the British government. There's no conspiracy, but everyone loves a mystery. On that note, I'm afraid I'm going to have to say goodbye, but it's been great talking to you, David.
Good talking to you, Mr. Pope. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye. This is WHFR.FM, the station making waves. You're listening to We Are Not Alone. I'm David Twitchell, and our guest today is Dennis Balthasar. Mr. Balthasar is a retired civil engineer, and he is an independent researcher, journalist, and lecturer who presently resides in Roswell, New Mexico, home of the infamous UFO crash of 1947. His research focuses on Roswell incident. However, it extends to investigations of Area 51, underground bases, and ancient Egypt. Dennis is a certified MUFON field investigator. He writes editorials for several well-known websites and magazines. He is also the author of Searching for the Truth. He has been the guest on media shows to include The Today Show, Dateline, and Nightline, and too many more to include here. And we're happy to have him with us today. Welcome to the show, Dennis.
Thank you, Dave. Good to be on.
It's good to have you. You reside there in... beautiful downtown Roswell, correct?
Yep, we're having a nice cool day today. Right now it's about 102, 103.
Well, you got your jacket on, don't you?
Yep.
Good.
Kind of breezy this morning, this
afternoon. Breezy, isn't it? We're having the same chilly weather here, pretty much.
Actually, we're in a serious drought down here in the southwest. Fire going out in Arizona right now, and we've had several here... within about 60 miles of Roswell, we had some pretty good-sized fires in the last couple of weeks.
And, wow.
No moisture in sight. We've had less than a tenth of an inch of rain this year.
Okay. Well, this show is going to be airing on July 5th. So today, for all intents and purposes, is July 5th. So,
okay.
I'll bet you'll be even warmer then.
Probably, yeah.
So the Roswell Festival that happens every year is probably gone past now, right? In July?
First through the 4th this year, I believe.
First through the 4th of July?
Right.
Okay.
So the anniversary date of the Roswell incident is the 4th of July, and they try to have the festival around that date each year.
Right. Well, so this is going to air the day after the Roswell festival. So let's talk about last year. What happened at the Roswell Festival of note?
Well, it's been going on for the last several years, and two or three years ago, the mayor of the city decided that the city should take it over because the UFO Museum was handling it, and they weren't getting the response they should have got, they didn't think, so the city took it over, and then we got a new mayor last year, and he's decided to give it back to the UFO Museum again, and I don't know what's going to happen with that this year. I'm not going to be involved in it because I'm banned from the UFO Museum.
You are?
For whatever reason, they've chosen to ban me, but that's okay.
Really?
Yeah.
You have no idea why?
Well, I do have ideas, but I was involved with the museum from 96 to 98, 70 hours a week as a volunteer. I was a UFO investigator. I was on the board of directors and didn't particularly care for some of the things they were saying and putting out, and probably got crossways with them over that. And I don't know. I really don't have a good reason why they don't want me in it, but that's fine with me. The way it's operated, I'm not too happy with it anyway.
Really?
Well, I think it's a vitally needed facility for the public.
Yeah.
But the leadership that they currently have is not what I would call conducive to doing that.
Hmm. Well, have you spoken at the Roswell Festival?
Oh, yeah, many times in the past I have, to some of the bigger audiences that they've had.
Mm-hmm.
And it's unfortunate to live here in Roswell and not be involved with the museum, of course. But, you know, that's their decision, so...
Well,
Dave, I'm really looking at possibly hanging it up at the end of this year.
Okay.
I've become really frustrated with what I'm seeing at conferences with what I call woo-woos that have infiltrated serious UFO research. And I'm talking about card readers and chamas and psychics and things like that. With my background of civil engineering, I don't really expect us to get the answers unless through scientific research.
That's right.
I certainly don't think that a card reader is going to determine whether UFOs exist or ETs are real or not.
Well, you know, that all deals with the paranormal, as what they call paranormal. That word is kind of tricky, paranormal.
Right.
It suggests that it happens outside of what is natural, but... it only happens outside of what is normal. I mean, we don't normally have a UFO parked in front of us.
That's right.
Or we don't normally, people don't normally become abducted by aliens.
I'll give you an example. Last September, I was master of ceremonies for the conference up at Angel Fire, New Mexico, up in the northern part of the state.
Mm-hmm.
I was responsible for introducing people like Stanton Friedman, John Greenewald Jr., Travis Walton, who are names you're familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I had to introduce a tinfoil hat contest.
A tinfoil hat.
Which just didn't set well with somebody who's had an engineering background and tried to do serious research all these years.
Yeah. You know, I say it's all right to laugh at ourselves once in a while. However, when you're having that kind of a conference, a kind of a festival, conference. You know, you should show up in suit and tie. I wouldn't think of doing it any other way. You're giving a lecture, not the audience, but the lecturer.
No.
And I've seen him. There's one whose name I will not mention, but you probably know who I'm talking about. Gives his lectures in jeans and a T-shirt.
Mm-hmm.
And he's supposed to be a serious UFO investigator.
Yeah.
Well, you know, he doesn't come across as serious. So I know I feel your pain there. So who?
I'll be 70 years old in October, and you know, really this is my third career, so I've been really fortunate over the years to have three careers that I've enjoyed. And I've done a lot of good research over the years. I worked with Stanton Friedman a lot, with Scott Ramsey out of North Carolina, who is probably the authority on the Aztec crash up in northern New Mexico in 1948.
Right.
Frank Warren, who has the UFO Chronicles on the Internet. And those are all guys that I respect. In fact, I just emailed Travis Walton yesterday to find out if they were okay with that fire up in Arizona, because he lives out in Snowflake, Arizona.
Yeah.
And he wrote back and said they were okay.
Yeah.
I mean, these are the type of people that I normally deal with, and I don't have any use. I think they may have their own agenda, but I think they should have their own conference, too. I don't think it should be intermixed with UFO research.
Right. It may be to try to attract a larger crowd, those interested in UFOs, those interested in psychic phenomenon. I can understand that. However, I can see your point.
Yeah,
I can see your point completely. Yeah. I've been to the UFO Congress. Now,
well, the fact remains, Dave, that, Roswell happened 64 years ago.
Right.
And we've been given four excuses over that time, and still don't know what happened here, really.
Right.
I mean, I've talked to many firsthand witnesses, and what they tell me is not something that was ours, the Russians, the Japanese, or the Germans.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, whose was it, and where was it from, and what was their motive?
Right. So how many witnesses to Roswell do you think you've interviewed?
Personally, I've looked at it. I've talked to probably 100 to 150 first, second, and third-hand witnesses. And over the years, Don Schmidt, Stanton Friedman, David Rudiak, and several other researchers, we probably have interviewed well up to 500 to 1,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of like the judicial system. You know, in our judicial system, we can put a person away for life or even execute them based on the testimony of one witness.
Right.
We have hundreds of witnesses and can't get in the courtroom.
That's right. Well, you actually have millions of witnesses. I would be there testifying. I'm a witness. You know, I say there are skeptics, believers, and witnesses, and I'm a witness, so probably the only reason I believe is because I'm a witness.
Well, when I was with the museum, Glenn Dennis, a mortician, Walter Hout, who wrote the press release, and a businessman named Max Littell were the founders of the museum, and I talked to them guys every day.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I've had firsthand knowledge of who was here and what took place.
Mm-hmm.
And to be lied to like we are by the government, you know, I get tired of that, because that's one of the frustrating things about doing this research, is you're banging your head against the wall all the time.
Yeah. Well, I just talked to Nick Pope, and I asked him, you know, he mentioned something about the government hiding something. And I said, well, you know, is the government hiding something? You worked in the government.
Huh?
he did, and, you know, the MOD for the UK. I said, is the government hiding something? No, there's no cover-up, he said. Now, wait a minute. Now, he went in as a skeptic, so he admitted it. He went in as a skeptic, understandable. So did Hynek, J. Allen Hynek. But after being forced to study the evidence, like J. Allen Hynek, he came to the conclusion, you know, there's something going on. There's something out there.
Mm-hmm.
And yet the governments tell us, you know, put it in the same category as the Easter Bunny. But then he says there's no cover-up. That doesn't square with me.
Our government has had a lot of experience with cover-up. a couple of examples. Area 51 was opened in 1955 by the CIA to test the U-2 aircraft. We didn't find out about Area 51 until the 1980s, when we got a hold of a Russian satellite picture. The atomic bomb, which was developed right here in New Mexico, had over 50,000 people involved for about 10 years.
Yeah.
That was kept secret. The F-117 stealth aircraft was on the drawing board in 1973 at the Skunk Works.
Mm.
We found out about it in 1991 in the Gulf War. So Our government has had a lot of experience in cover-up, and they're good at it. And I don't buy the fact that they talk, well, there'll be panic. The more educated people are, the more likely they are to believe that UFOs exist.
The polls have shown that, yes.
Yeah, and, you know, when you look at the different Roper polls and things, most people believe that the government is hiding something, and all those percentages are higher than what politicians get elected by.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's time for the people in Washington, both military, and I'm not talking all military, I'm talking several military people and government officials, it's time for them to, you know, come clean.
Right, right. Well, I don't know if they are or not. I think that they are slowly coming clean. I think that they are leaking this information here and there. Letting it come out. Some of the documents show up on the websites. The UK's documents are showing up on their on the websites, and they're indoctrinating us with movies. Albeit all of these movies with UFOs or aliens, they're all trying to kill us.
That's a good possibility that we're being educated.
Mm.
One of the problems I have is who in our government is going to admit that they've been lying to us for 64 years? I don't think that's going to happen.
They're all tossing the hot potato, aren't they?
Now, I do have a theory on Roswell, which is my theory alone, and that is whatever was recovered, and we know there was no craft recovered. It was pieces of a craft.
Right.
All right, whatever was recovered, 64 years later, they still don't know what they have.
Now
they don't know the propulsion system, the guidance, the motivation for coming here, where they were from.
Right.
And until our government gets a military advantage out of that information, they're not going to admit it happened or that they know anything about it.
Right. Yes, I believe they said back then in 47, as soon as we get a handle on this and are in control, we'll tell the people.
Yeah.
That day is yet to come.
Right.
So, now you just said they don't have the craft, they have pieces of it.
Right.
That's the first time I've heard that.
Well, the only thing found at the debris field were pieces, the largest being 3-4 feet in diameter. They were scattered over 3/4 of a mile by several hundred yards wide when the rancher, Mac Braswell, found the material. So, there was either an impact or an explosion above ground that took place, and there was no craft intact. It was only pieces of what they called debris, which was brought into Hangar 84 here at Roswell Army Airfield, which no longer exists, by the way, and then shipped to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton, Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
Today, I believe, it's probably at Area 51 for better security.
Hmm. Now, see, that's another thing I've heard, that everything has been moved from Area 51.
Well, that's not true.
Okay.
And I can verify that. They just built another 10 or 12,000 foot runway. They just built another gigantic hangar, and they put in some new water tanks because I think most of the ground up there is radioactive because they've been burning toxic waste above ground for years.
Yeah. No, but
they're exempt from environmental laws, which all industry have to comply with.
No, of course they're experimenting with our technologies at Area 51. That's to be expected. But what I meant was they have, from my understanding, they have moved any alien bodies, any alien technologies from Area 51. What do you think?
That's possible, and we never know how many employees are at Area 51 because, like most secret bases, including White Sands and Edwards Air Force Base, when they get through with the project, the guys are moved around to other locations. So you could have as little as 500 people and as many as 4,000 working at Area 51 at any given time. I was up there a couple of years ago and did a couple of lectures at Rachel, the little town near the base, and went out to both gates, and it is still very, very active, I can assure you, because I was watched by the guards and the cameras and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Now, going back to the debris field and no actual craft, there were allegedly bodies, three dead, one alive, found at Roswell. Is this true?
I'm not sure about the one alive. I've heard that story myself, and I've heard numbers anywhere from three to five bodies. Never been able to confirm a factual number on that, but the bodies were not found at the debris field. They were found probably within a mile of the debris field, indicating that they may have been in some kind of a capsule or something, and you either realized they were crashing and ejected, or the capsule was separated from the craft when it went down.
There was supposed to be a, I believe, Boy Scout troop that came across the capsule or craft, whichever it was, and came across the bodies. Is that right?
Nah, that's a different case, I believe.
Oh?
The one for the Roswell incident was found by Mac Brazel, who was ranch foreman on the Foster Ranch. And that's
yeah, just the debris then.
Yeah, so that's some 70 miles northwest of Roswell,
mm-hmm.
About 12 miles from the town of Corona.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, it was called the Roswell incident because the military was stationed here. And your listeners need to know that the military that was stationed here was the 509th Bomb Wing.
Right.
Those are the guys that dropped the atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki to end the Second World War.
Mm-hmm.
So they were the best military people we had in the world at the time. And, you know, to think that they were responsible for handling and delivering the atomic bomb and too dumb to know the difference between a weather balloon and a flying saucer, that's a major problem for me.
Yeah. Yeah, I believe that it was, you know, UFOs were such a secret that not even the higher-ups at Roswell knew it was a secret, keep quiet. They just weren't told anything, and when the disc crashed, or the debris, they found the debris field, whichever it was, they didn't know to keep quiet about it. That was the secret.
Colonel Blanchard was the base commander, and
right.
He was head of the 509th, so
right.
He went on to become a four-star general at the Pentagon and considered for Joint Chief,
mm-hmm.
Extremely sharp. And Jesse Marcel, Major Marcel, was the intelligence officer and the top intelligence officer in the world at the time.
Mm-hmm.
He had just gone through a balloon school learning about the use of balloons, so he knew what a balloon looked like.
He must
have been. The rancher had found balloons before because they had tags on them for a reward and could be turned in for a cash reward of a few dollars. And what he found was not anything that he had recognized or had seen before. Marcel went out to the debris field with Colonel Cavett.
Yeah.
When the rancher came to town, he came to the sheriff, Sheriff Wilcox, and told him he had this stuff strewn all over his pasture.
Mm-hmm.
And the sheriff didn't know what it was, so he contacted the military, and they got a hold of Major Marcel. Marcel and Captain Cavett, the other intelligence officer, went out to the ranch with the rancher, spent the night on the ranch, and the next day picked up as much debris as they could get in their vehicles and came back to town. Marcel was shipped to Fort Worth to General Ramey's office with some of the debris, where the pictures were taken the next day, and General Ramey said it was nothing but a weather balloon.
Right.
That story lasted until the second excuse came out. He said it wasn't a weather balloon. It was a Mogul balloon, which was a high-altitude balloon used to check to see if the Russians were doing any nuclear testing.
Yeah, but the first explanation was we've got one of those flying discs that people have been seeing.
Now, that's right. The only time in the history of the United States that the media has put a headline out saying that we have a flying saucer in our possession.
Mm-hmm. So this
and
was
that was written by Lieutenant Walter Haught, who was a public relations officer for Colonel Blanchard.
Right. Now, and Blanchard goes on, you know, it would seem like Blanchard or Haught would have been reprimanded for putting out, you know, not being able to tell the difference between a weather balloon or any kind of balloon and a crashed disc.
Well, I talked and to Walter about this, and Walter said that he questioned Blanchard when he was told to write the article, and Blanchard said, that is the way I want it written.
Wow.
And then I think that that conversation was probably after Blanchard had already talked to General Ramey in Fort Worth, which is over Roswell, and probably Washington. And they figured they'd put out this story and then be able to debunk it the next day, and that would be the end of it.
But why?
And that pretty much is the way it happened.
But why would, if they wanted to keep it secret, why would they have put the story out in the first place that it was a crash disk?
Because it was so far-fetched, nobody would believe it. And then when General Ramey came out the next day, within 14 hours, General Ramey said it was not a flying saucer. It was a weather balloon. And then later he said, no, it wasn't a flying saucer or a weather balloon. It was a Mogul balloon.
Yeah, it was years later, though, the Mogul balloon.
Mogul balloons were supposed to be used to check the Russians for nuclear testing. They didn't do any nuclear testing till 1949, 2 years after the Roswell incident. And then in 1997, they came out with the Air Force came out with another report saying they had not addressed the bodies that had been talked about, and the bodies were anthropomorphic crash test dummies.
Mm-hmm.
The dummies weren't used till 1953, 6 years after their Roswell incident. So the Air Force pretty well shot himself in the foot with that one.
Yeah, as Stanton Friedman refers to them as time-traveling crash test dummies.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
I got to take a moment just to remind our listeners that you are listening to WHFR.FM, the only station making waves here out of Henry Ford Community College in Dearborn, Michigan. I'm David Twitchell, and you're listening to We Are Not Alone. And we're speaking with Mr. Dennis Balthasar. And researcher and author, Dennis Balthasar. And let's talk for a minute, Dennis, about underground bases. I've been wanting to get somebody on here that knows something about underground bases.
I think my interest in that, Dave, came from the fact that my background was civil engineering.
Hmm.
And for years, I'd been curious about these rumors I heard about these facilities underground and whether, in fact, they existed, how they were made, and for what purpose. And one of the things that shocked me kind of when I started doing the research was to find out how much FEMA, Federal Emergency Management Agency, is involved.
Mm-hmm.
They have over 100 underground facilities. Most were originally set up for continuity of government during the Cold War years. The president has a location that he goes to. The Congress has a location just outside of Washington in Virginia.
Right.
And the Pentagon has a facility in Raven Rock, Pennsylvania, just over the Pennsylvania border,
mm-hmm.
where in the event of an emergency, our key people would be able to go underground and still communicate and mm-hmm. Transact their business.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's understandable.
The equipment that is used is just mind-boggling. Some of these boring machines. I was able to get a patent and a drawing of a patent number of a nuclear machine that goes through the earth and melts the rock and sand and dirt and forms a glass-like lining behind the machine, not requiring anything to be taken underground or any dirt brought out of the ground.
Hmm.
So that thing could come through the earth at a mile deep or so, and no one would ever know that it was there.
Wow. Well, so the how many underground now? It's no secret that we have underground bases. All governments have underground bases.
Yeah,
protect
and that's
themselves.
Become a necessity because of satellites.
Right, right.
You can't do anything above ground anymore because they can read a newspaper from 200 miles up. So anything that's secretive is going to either be done inside an enclosure, a hangar, or a building.
Right.
Or be underground, and it's of my opinion that most of the military bases in the western United States, at least, are interconnected somehow.
Hmm.
We know of facilities like Area 51 supposedly has 22 levels below ground.
Mm-hmm.
There's a base in California that has 35, one has 42 levels below ground. White Sands Missile Range, which is 100 miles south of here, has 7, I know of 4. They did some laser testing on the fourth level.
Hmm.
So it's fairly common, and like you said, nearly all countries have these facilities.
Right. But what evidence, if any, exists to suggest Earth's government are working with extraterrestrials at these bases?
Mostly rumors.
Mostly rumors.
The big one is Dulce.
Okay.
There's been talk about biogenetics taking place there on the seventh level below ground. I was up there a couple years ago, did a lecture with Norio Hayakawa. That's part of the Hickory Apache Indian Reservation, and they weren't too happy that us white guys were there. But the meeting was set up for a Sunday starting at 10 o'clock. And about 6 o'clock that morning, everybody at the hotel was woken up by what sounded like a helicopter. And we went outside, and there was a black, unmarked helicopter hovering over the hotel. I think he was probably checking license plates to see who was there for the meeting. We got a few stories from the locals, from the Native Americans, but I got the impression that if they see something in the sky, they believe it's personal and they don't want to talk about it.
They believe it's personal?
Yeah, they think it's a personal thing if they see anything. There was talk about an air shaft being found up on the Archuleta Mesa. It's going to require a lot more research to prove that anything is going on. Phil Schneider, of course, talked about it, you know, and some people have debunked him, that he was involved in a firefight when they broke through into a chamber below ground up there.
Right. With E.T.?
He said that they were doing biogenetics there with animals and humans, and they were working with aliens on the ground, and the firefight happened, and he was hit. Most of the guys that were with him died of cancer, and he went public, and 6 months later was found dead in his apartment with a piano wire wrapped around his neck saying he had committed suicide.
And shot 3 times. Worst case of suicide I've ever seen.
Well, you can't do yourself in with a piano wire. You're going to give it up before you die.
I know it.
So, that's kind of like James Forrestal, the defense secretary, when supposedly jumped out the window of the hospital where he was. The only window that didn't have bars on it.
Yeah, tenth story, I believe it was, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, it's supposed to be a psychiatric ward. Now, even back in those days, what kind of a hospital is going to put psychiatric patients 10 stories up where there's a window that they could jump out of, and yet he committed suicide?
You're asking too many questions,
Dave. Oh, I hope the government's not listening. Ooh.
Well, they probably are. They don't have anything better to do.
They're probably chuckling, too. You think that's the first time that question has ever been asked? Doesn't make sense.
I don't think the government really has to hide this anymore. I think there's so much confusion around the UFO situation. It goes back to what I originally talked about, these woo-boos that get involved, and I would think the government's probably sitting back laughing at us for sort of mass confusion that we've created.
Yeah, it is mass confusion. And they can just sit back and say, prove it.
Yeah.
Prove it.
That's exactly, you hit on a really key point there, because, my phone's been tapped and things like that. But
really?
I can say just about anything I want because I can't prove anything.
That's it. I had my sighting back in 1962, and hundreds of people in the Detroit area witnessed this thing. My whole family witnessed this thing, and they said, those crazy people saw the Northern Lights. Well, this is a huge structured craft with huge lights on it that emerge from a pinpoint in the sky. And, we were standing there agog. My mother said it was the second coming. And my father didn't have a clue. Both of them had seen the Northern Lights. My dad spent 2 years in Alaska. He knew what the Northern Lights looked like, but none of us knew what we were looking at. And they said, it's the Northern Lights. And, They weren't telling us because we saw it.
Well, you know, there's been cases like, well, the Phoenix Lights for one thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then you had the incident at O'Hare Airport here last 2 years ago.
Right.
I mean, those are credible cases. And you hear about them, and then a day or two later, it's no longer news.
No. No, they drop
quieted, it. And you don't hear any more about it.
Right.
I think the media is probably the biggest problem we have. I love doing radio because radio or shows like you have here, you're not doing any editing on it.
No.
It's live, and if it's wrong, it's wrong. If it's right, it's right. Yeah, but you're not going to take it out of context.
No, but that happens.
And that happens a lot with documentaries.
All
the time.
I'm fed
up with TV documentaries because I've spent hour after hour filming with these people only to have that film taken back to New York or Los Angeles. Some clown edits it and puts a different question with my answer.
Oh, yeah. I believe it.
We had Stanton Friedman and I had a big problem with the National Geographic Channel years ago where we spent hours and hours and we used my vehicle to run all over southeast New Mexico. And when the show aired, the last thing the announcer said was that Roswell was a myth. And there's no reimbursement. People think that UFO researchers make all these big money from books and stuff like that. That's just not true. I lose about $3,000 to $4,000 a year doing this research. But I think it's important. And because of that, my wife let me do it, and I've continued to do it for the last 15 years. But, you know, when you get right down to it, I think radio and maybe writing editorials that you have copyrighted are the only way to really get factual information out to the public.
Yeah. Yeah, because especially public radio like WHFR.
Yeah.
You know, put that plug in for WHFR because, you know, the public should know. And if we had a commercial station here, we probably couldn't do this kind of show.
That's right.
Because, number one, the sponsors would complain. And if the sponsors didn't complain, someone would complain to, you know, it's like this guy who, this is what I heard, allegedly, the reporter who broke the story in Roswell originally that we were in possession of a disc. Somebody walked in and said, "You ever repeat that story, and we're going to pull the plug on your radio station."
That's right.
And so
that was the owner of KGFX.
Right.
KGFL radio. Yeah.
Right. So
he had a recording of the rancher, and he got a teletype saying that if you ever air that, you might as well look for another job because you're going to the radio station is shut down.
That's it. So
I think with TV, and you made a good point a while ago, but that they may be trying to release some information gradually.
Yeah.
But I really believe that with documentaries and things like that, there's only two things important. One is ratings, and the other is profit.
Yeah,
they could really care less about factual information.
Yeah, I know. I think UFO Hunters was with Bill Burns was one of the most in-depth investigative shows. You know,
it was, but I thought it was too much of a reality show. Really.
But then they pulled it off.
He did some good work. I was on the show a couple of times, and I know Bill real well. But again, because of sponsors and ratings and things like that, you know, he's not there anymore.
The ratings were low?
No, the ratings were good.
Well, then what's the deal? Why is he gone?
Probably too much information.
That is my exact point. There's too much information. They were, presenting, usually these documentaries present the mystery, and then the last 15 minutes of an hour-long show, they give the skeptical scientific baloney excuses. But not so with UFO Hunters, and somebody didn't like that.
Right.
That's my opinion. Can't prove it.
I think that's right.
As the government's saying right now, prove it, Dave.
Yeah.
Prove it, Dennis. Right. Am I right? What, if any, significance do you feel the pyramids of Egypt have with the UFO phenomenon?
Well, we have one researcher on the association I belong to who, through someone he found in Egypt, and he has a name, and I can't recall what the name is for him, but he doesn't have anything written down. It's all in his head, and he's now passed away and passed it on to his daughter. But he talked about a civilization that lived in North Africa 10, 15,000 years ago called Khemitians, K-H-E-M-I-T-I-A-N. And that was a black civilization predominantly controlled by women, females, who supposedly had contact with star people. And he said the opinion that the technology to build the pyramids may have come from star people to these people, which would predate the Egyptian civilization. And I have no doubt at all that the three pyramids of Giza, just the three of Giza and the Sphinx, were built much earlier than the Egyptian civilization.
Oh, that has been proven. They've dug down at the pyramid. They didn't know the Sphinx. They didn't know the Sphinx had feet at one point.
Well, they didn't know it had a body. It was covered in sand up to the neck until the 1800s.
Right.
And then they uncovered it and found the body of the lion.
Right.
And if you look at the Sphinx, the deterioration on the back is caused by water, not by sand and wind. And there hasn't been that amount of water in that part of the world for about 15,000 years, which predates the Egyptian civilization.
All right. So
now, the thing is, tourism is big business in Egypt. And it's going to be hard for any of us to prove that the pyramids were not built by the Egyptians, but that's the theory we go by.
Yeah. Well, you know, I can't probably pronounce the name of that guy. He just retired, Egyptologist there in Egypt. He got angry with ufologists for suggesting that E.T. built or helped Egyptians build the pyramids. He said that we were insulting the Egyptian people.
Well, if you do the calculations on the pyramid, on the big pyramid, you have 2.5 million stones, not including the casing stones that covered it at one time. Those had to be quarried miles away from the location of the pyramids. They had to be quarried, shaped, loaded on barges, put up the Nile River, transported over to the site. And for 2.5 million stones to be placed by 20 to 30,000 workers over a 20 or 30 year period, they would have had to set a stone every 90 seconds.
Every 90 seconds.
I've done the math on this.
Really?
If you look at a ramp to get the stones up to 450 feet in the air, there would have been more material in the ramp than there is in the pyramid. And every lift that they went up, they would have had to increase the width of the ramp to compensate for it. So, you know, there's just too many theories by Egyptologists that just don't hold water mathematically.
And at any rate, that we can't build it. We've tried. We can't build an exact replica of a pyramid of today with all of our technology and all of our cranes and all of our, you know, people.
You talk about technology. The pyramids are off by a quarter inch on each side. The last big job I did was over the Houston Ship Channel at a bridge with a 1,200-foot span, and when we got to the middle putting it together, we were off by 3 feet on 1,200 feet. That was pretty good engineering.
But I was going to say, but that was a pretty good job, right?
Yeah. We dropped a piece of steel in there and completed it.
Huh.
But for the pyramids that have been built when they were built and be off a quarter inch on each side, it's just phenomenal.
So you guys just finished and said, that's 3 feet? That's close enough, huh? My goodness.
I don't know how they were built. I really don't.
I don't either. So
there are no records anywhere of how they were built or who built them.
So what is your guess on it? Do you think they had help or were built by someone else?
Can you picture building those with what I just said about the time factor using copper tools?
Yeah. No.
See, that's the problem I have with it.
the copper, the tool, I was a die maker, the tool has to be harder than what you're working with.
Right, right.
Period.
Well, now they're limestone. Most of the rocks are limestone, which is not a real hard rock. But I think the top part of the pyramid was probably cast like we do concrete today, maybe formed, because the tops of those stones are pretty flat. The bottom, there's no doubt about it, that they were quarried somewhere. Mm-hmm. And we know where the quarry was. It was miles away. They talk about the Great Pyramid having been built for Khufu of the 4th Dynasty.
Mm-hmm.
When the Arabs first went in the pyramid in 890 A.D., they found nothing in there for the afterlife. The only thing they found was an empty box, a coffer, in the king's chamber. No hieroglyphics, nothing for the afterlife. And the only thing they've ever found on Khufu is a 3-inch statue miles away from the pyramids, which is in the Cairo Museum.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't believe that pyramid was ever built for a pharaoh for the afterlife. I do believe that it may have been an energy machine of some kind.
Now, that's pretty much what I was getting at, an energy machine. I've heard some stories, I mean, seemingly pretty wild stories, that one day those pyramids are going to turn on and emit some kind of energy. What is that all about? Do you buy into that? Have you heard these?
Your car is one of our researchers who spent 2 nights on top of the Great Pyramid, the flat part on top, which was never finished, apparently, using equipment. And he suspects that there was a bubble around the pyramid and some form of energy that he believes is connected to the 11-year sunspot cycle. And there's shafts in there that they haven't been able to open up, doors that have blocked the shafts and things like that.
Right.
We just don't know a whole lot about the pyramids other than they're, unlike UFOs, they're physically standing there and we can look at them. But where did they come from? How were they built? I don't have the answers for that.
But we, you know, it's just like the UFO technology, assuming we have it, assuming that we have crash discs. You're standing there looking at it. There it is right in front of you, but you don't have a clue as to how it works.
Well, if, let me use the word if.
Okay.
If ETs can get here from wherever they're from,
right,
they obviously have technology and knowledge that we cannot even comprehend.
Right.
Because we can't go there. So if you look at the technology that we have developed over the last 100 years, and consider that a civilization out there in space may be 1,000 years, 10,000 years ahead of us,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's no way to comprehend what they might know or be able to do.
Yeah. And yet there are rumors that, according to Corso, I don't know how much stock you put in that, but there are some things, technologies that we have that we're back engineered from alien technologies.
I met him. I met him 3 times. Really liked him as a person.
Mm-hmm.
Neat guy. I read the book with great interest, but I have a problem with nothing in the back of the book for reference.
Hmm.
Not one reference in that book. And part of it was written by Bill Burns. We don't know how much Burns wrote and how much Corso wrote. His thinking makes sense to me that the technology could have been handed to industry. However, he talked about microchips, and microchips we know were developed at Texas Instruments because the guy got the Nobel Peace Prize for it.
Now, yeah, but when?
Pardon?
But when were they developed? When were the development begin on microchips?
Well, I was after Roswell, yeah.
There you go.
Night vision, Corso talked about night vision. We had night vision, we were researching night vision from the Second World War, the old red night vision, and now we have the green night vision. I enjoyed the book, I really did, and I enjoyed Corso, but I just have a lot of problem with it not being any references.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well,
when you're doing this research on UFOs, you have to have confirmation and validity.
Right.
Because there's too many waiting out there, too many debunkers and critics waiting to jump on you if you don't.
Really?
And I think that's one of the problems with UFO research is that there's 2,000 websites on Roswell.
Wow. 2,000.
And 90% of those people have never been here. Never interviewed a witness, don't know where the crash sites are. They're second, third-hand armchair researchers.
But they have read books, right?
Probably, yeah. Probably.
So that makes them authorities, I guess.
Makes them an authority, yeah.
Wow. So anyway. So your theory is on the pyramids that they are an energy machine of some kind.
Based on what Joe Parr has learned and others that I've talked to that are on this research association I belong to, we have a feeling that they were built as some form of energy machine of some kind.
But are they still functional, or will they be functional in the future?
I think they might be functional if we knew how to operate them.
Somebody's going to go in there one day and press a button or hit a,
well,
hit a stone.
Well, you know, Napoleon went in there and spent the night in the king's chamber, and he came out the next day and was totally shook up. And somebody said he had some vision of his future or something while he was in there. And I've talked to other people that have been inside the pyramid, and they said the feeling they get is totally unexplainable.
Hmm. Yeah, well, you know, I've had experience with smaller pyramids and bigger ones. I've sat under, I had back problems years ago, and sat under a copper pyramid for about 20 minutes. And everything, as I'm looking out, the colors got vivid. And when I got out from under there, my back problem was gone. You believe
that?
Oh,
really?
Now, this wasn't psychological, but because I was not expecting anything. I just, you know, they said, sit down under this pyramid.
Uh-huh.
And so I did. I wasn't expecting anything. And there you are. So who knows? Who knows?
Well, you've heard the story about putting razor blades in pyramids.
Yes.
To stay sharp.
And I've done that with small pyramids, and it actually works.
We have a researcher, Vladimir Krasnolovich. Mm-hmm. I love it when I can say that. He's a Ukrainian, and he has done some work with the Russian Scientific Society, and they built some pyramids, and he claims that seeds, plants, germinate much quicker and have much more production in a pyramid. He talked about viruses not forming in a pyramid, and he even said that water didn't freeze at 20 below zero or something like that.
Yeah.
There's just a whole lot of mystery around the pyramid shape and what its function is.
Yeah. Dennis Balthasar. Where can we go to check out more of your work?
Where can we what?
Go to check out your work.
TruthSeeker@Roswell.com.
TruthSeeker@Roswell.com.
And all one word, TruthSeeker@Roswell. I get probably 50 to 100 emails a day, and I do try to answer those that are valid, so if anybody listening wants to drop me an email, please have them get a hold of me.
Very good.
I've got a section on there for my editorials, which I've been writing since 1999. There's probably 64, 65 editorials that I've written that refer to the research that I've done over the years.
Very good. Well, Dennis, thank you so much for joining us today. And
my pleasure.
I hope we can do this again sometime.
All right. Take care.
Okay. Bye-bye. And if our listeners have any questions or comments for me, you can email me at dtwitchell@hotmail.com. This show, as well as all the forum shows, is now archived at whfr.fm's website. Click on the forum button on the homepage. We Are Not Alone is also archived at my website, ufoimplications.com. That's ufoimplications.com. Please stay tuned to WHFR.FM, the only station making waves, for the best in alternative programming. I want to thank you for joining us today. Please join us again the first Tuesday of each month at 1 p.m., when we will again explore the mysteries of the UFO phenomenon. And until then, This is David Twitchell reminding you to keep an eye on the sky.
The American Lung Association, we're fighting for a day when we can all breathe easier. We're fighting for clear skies over every city and healthy lungs throughout the country. We're fighting to free millions of Americans from the addictive grip of tobacco and the devastating effects of lung disease. The American Lung Association isn't just fighting for air, we're fighting for all the things that make it worth breathing, and we can use your help. See what you can do at fightingforair.org.
Arthur C. Clarke once observed, "Two possibilities exist. Either we are alone in the universe, or we are not. Both are equally terrifying." Join your host, David Twitchell, the first Tuesday of each month at 1 p.m., when he and special guests examine the scientific evidence on We Are Not Alone, right here on WHFR. FM 89.3. That's the first Tuesday of each month at 1 p.m. We are not alone.
WHFR.FM is a proud media sponsor of the 19th annual Concert of Colors. This free 4-day diversity festival featuring tons of live music will take place July 14th through the 17th. For performance times and locations or any additional information, visit www.concertofcolors.com. That's www.concertofcolors.com.
WHFR, Dearborn.
Have you ever had dreams or visions that did come true? Have you ever experienced deja vu? Has your intuition provided you with a clue on what to do? Or are you simply interested in something exciting and new? If so, check out Metaphysically Speaking every third Tuesday of the month from 1 to 2. Only on WHFR.FM, the station that is celebrating 25 years of broadcasting.
Henry Ford Community College and Oakwood Healthcare are proud sponsors of the 2011 Dearborn Farmers and Artisan Market. The Dearborn Farmers and Artisan Market is open Fridays from 8 a.m. to 1 p.m. now through October 28th and is located next to the Bryant Library on Michigan Avenue in West Dearborn. For more information, call 313-673-4207. That's 313-673-4207. Or visit online at www.dearbornfarmersartisansmarket.com.